Mum and Dad and Denny saw the passing out parade at Puckapunyal. It was a long march from cadets. 6th Battalion was the next to tour, and it was me who drew the card. We did Canungra and Shoalwater before we left. And Townsville lined the footpaths as we marched down to the quay. This clipping from the paper shows us young and strong and clean. And there's me in me slouch hat with me SLR and greens. God help me, I was only 19. From Vung Tau riding Chinooks to the dust at Nui Dat, I've been in and out of choppers now for months. We made our tents a home, VB and pin-ups on the lockers, and an Asian orange sunset through the scrub. And can you tell me, doctor, why I still can't get to sleep? And night time's just a jungle dark and a barking M16. And what's this rash that comes and goes? Can you tell me what it means? God help me, I was only 19. Four-week operation, when each step could mean your last one on two legs. It was a war within yourself, but you wouldn't let your mates down till they had you dusted off. So you closed your eyes and thought about something else. And then someone yelled out, contact! And the bloke behind me swore. We hooked in there for hours, then a god almighty roar. And Frankie kicked to mind the day that mankind kicked the moon. God help me, he was going home in June. I can still see Frankie drinking tinnies in the Grand Hotel on a 36-hour rec leave in Vung Tau. And I can still see Frankie lying screaming in the jungle till the morphine came and killed the bloody row. And the Anzac legends didn't mention mud and blood and tears. And the stories that my father told me never seemed quite real. I caught some pieces in my back that I didn't even feel. God help me, I was only 19. And can you tell me, doctor, why I still can't get to sleep? And why the Channel 7 chopper chills me to my feet? And what's this rash that comes and goes? Can you tell me what it means? God help me, I was only 19.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Confronting Climate Change. The urgency of the climate crisis has compelled writers such as Bill McKibben and Antonia Pujas to cross the line into advocacy. Bill McKibben says that 75% of Americans know that climate change is real and want something done about it.
So, Antonia Pujas, South Africa was one country. It was isolated. The oil industry, fossil fuel industry, is much more powerful. Do you think divestiture will have more than a symbolic impact? And if so, how?
Well, I think first you can't undermine the significance of the symbolism. So, you know, one of the things that's very true about the oil industry is that wherever it operates, those places where its operations are taking place tend to be very economically disenfranchised communities. Right here, where we live, 16 miles away, Richmond is where the Chevron refinery operates, a number of refineries operating in Contra Costa County, a very low-income, struggling community whose voice does not often get heard in its confrontations with the industry. It's true all across the country. I covered the BP oil spill. You know, talk about communities that have been struggling to try and hold their oil companies to account, very much within a vacuum, very much without the attention of the rest of the state, much less the country, much less the world. So when people on college campuses who have the opportunity, or cities or states, certainly the divestiture movement does not need to be limited to college campuses, as the city of San Francisco shows.
That's right.
You're saying a voice, for the betterment of our the functioning right here in communities right here who don't have a voice, as well as internationally. I think one of the other things that the movement has been able to do is to call attention to hypocrisy within the industry. A lot of the pushback that movements for divestiture have gotten with the oil companies are, well, they're leading the way. They're investing in alternative energy, so we want to support them because they have the capacity to shift us better towards alternative energy. The reality is that is just so not the case. Hitting a height around 2006, the oil industry was putting a lot of attention into the fact that they were looking at alternative energy. BP, of course, famously changed its name to Beyond Petroleum. Well, as of this year, BP is completely out of the alternative energy business, as are most of the oil companies. At best, BP was the highest investor, and at its height, it was 4% of its total exploratory and capital budget to alternative energy, and that was the best. Most of the companies are at 2%, 1%, 0%, and most are on a downhill slide. Instead, where they're really focusing is on oil, because now we're letting them go get oil wherever they want, in the tar sands, deep, deep, deep offshore, in whatever country you're living in. In the Arctic, shale. We're letting them get it at the same time as the price is high, high, high. So they are doubling down on oil and shifting away from alternatives and the dirtiest, scariest types of oil you have to fight wars for to get. So part of the symbolism of the divestiture movement is to say we actually know the facts, which is that this industry is stepping backwards, not forwards, and we're going to shine a light on that. And that symbolism allows for messages that don't often get to be told in places like the media and in commercials and in places we don't have as much access to even as reporters.
So is the hope then that divestment pressure will have them invest more capital into cleaner sources of energy? Or what's the goal here?
The hope is that it'll weaken them politically. And if they're weakened politically, then we can start about the work of regulating this industry instead of letting it just run roughshod over everything. They're always going to be powerful, but at the moment, the power imbalance is so great between them and anybody else that it isn't even a contest. I mean, 2009, there was the weakest possible climate legislation that one could have written, this cap and trade bill that would have done virtually nothing except that it would have at least established the idea that we were going to try and regulate carbon. The Senate, then with 60 Democrats, was so terrified of the oil industry that Harry Reid wouldn't even bring the thing to a vote. The whip count, when he caved, showed that in the Senate with 60 Democrats, they had 43 votes in favor of this incredibly weak thing. It's not even close in Washington on almost anything. It's been a small miracle that we've been able to hold this Keystone Pipeline at bay for a couple of years. There's a reasonably good chance we're going to lose that fight over the next 6 months because the Obama administration talks a good game on this stuff, but that's all they do. And so we're, it's a completely unbalanced fight, and it's an attempt to put some balance in there.
Antonia Yuhas?
Yeah. So the other piece of that is, again, as it gets back to there, is there something that you can do about it? I think the biggest victory of the oil industry is making itself seem impenetrable, that activists, concerned citizens, people who live where the industry operates will always look somewhere else to do something because they don't feel like they can do anything about the oil industry. And that's not a coincidence. Part of it is by design, and I think one of the things that the industry has done very well is make it so that you also just sort of feel like, well, maybe they are really putting their energy in the right places, and so we don't have to worry about them on the long list of things we have to worry about. But I'm thinking about, for example, Chevron's human energy ad campaigns, which are designed, I don't think necessarily to make you think that they're investing, billions of dollars in AIDS research in Angola, which you might be surprised to learn that they're not, but rather to have you just sort of look away, say, well, clearly, they've got their heart in the right places. We know the oil industry does dirty things, operates in bad ways, but clearly they're not all bad, and so we can look at other things. And so part of what the divestiture movement does is create this space to just talk about them, open up the door, shine the sunlight. How much money are they actually investing in Angola? How much are they actually investing in, not investing in oil in Angola, but rather in healthcare in Angola? And how much are they investing in alternative energy? And to make it so you can start having a dialogue that's often very difficult to have around this industry at all.
They're very skillful. I mean, these guys have unlimited amounts of money to spend on public relations. And the strategy that they've hit on in regard to climate is just to keep insisting that though they'd like to do something, nothing can be done. And they put out a report, Exxon every year puts, it'll be 50 years before, whatever we do. Well, if they stay in charge, it sure will be 50 years, and probably 50 years from now, it'll be another 50 years, If we're able to break their power, then it won't be 50 years. And that's what this fight is about. And that's why they're terrified of the few counterexamples now we see around the world. So, for instance, the Germans, source of many of the problems of the 20th century, are doing their best to provide some of the solutions to the problems of the 21st. They're really doing a serious job on renewable energy. And that's the scariest thing that the oil industry can hear, is that there were days last summer when Germany generated half the power it used from solar panels within its borders. Okay? That's Germany. Munich is north of Montreal. Think what they could do if they were in, say, California.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Why they call me Wolf. Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Germany's doing a lot, but you're conflating oil and coal. I mean, oil's not really burned for electricity. Yeah. That might be a threat to the coal industry, and we haven't talked much about coal yet. And a lot of climatologists would say coal is really the big problem.
I drive a car now that takes electricity to make it run.
Me too.
And I plug it into the solar panel on my roof. So I'm, you know, if I was in Germany, I'd be just fine.
Right.
I take public transportation. but the other piece that I just wanted to add is we know that we're not going to not be using oil tomorrow. The question is, how do we move more quickly away from oil and coal? What's the best way to make that happen? One of the best ways to make that happen is to open this door on the fact that we actually can limit where the industry gets to work while we invest much more heavily in the meaningful alternatives. And again, I think the most important is public transportation. What happened with the discussion of peak oil, which disappeared because the more we were having the discussion about peak oil and the concerns about what would happen when we hit the peak, is that it created this really great door for the industry to say, yeah, you don't want that to happen. You better let us go wherever we want to go. And so we did. And so we pushed the peak further out because we opened places that I just think simply shouldn't be opened. But
exactly.
That pushed the peak out.
Well, and technology change is a big part of that.
But what's really important now, I mean, and it's a big part of this fight. I mean, we're playing offense when we do divestment and stuff, we're going after them, but we also have to play serious defense. And Tony is absolutely right. I mean, think about what folly it is to build something like the Keystone Pipeline. Connects to the dirtiest oil on earth and ensures that you'll be using it for 50 years once you've spent the money to build it and once you've provided that jolt of financing up to the people who want to expand the tar sands and things. It just keeps going. Our colleague Casey Golden at Climate Solutions in Seattle published a great essay where he said this is we're going to call this the Keystone Principle. We should make sure that we don't build new infrastructure that locks in our dependence on this stuff. Just the opposite. We should be starting to shut it down as quickly as we can, and in the process force ourselves to wean ourselves. I mean, you know, this is weaning is sort of the right metaphor here. You know, it's I remember our daughter, it's not the easiest process in the entire world, but it needs to happen, you know?
And I disagree. It was just this fundamental idea that it was technology that opened it up. It's technology plus utterly liberalized deregulation. So I disagree with the fact that the industry really has the technology mastered to go 7,000 feet out to do offshore. They don't. We learned it the hard way. BP was the evidence. And we've just allowed them to take steps in technology and turn it into we get to go wherever we want to go, however we want to do it. And you can also argue that they don't know how to do the tar sands given the environmental human costs of the tar sands. They actually don't know how to do it. If they can't capture it and do it cleaner and safer and healthier, I would argue that means they don't actually know how.
There actually is some carbon and capture sequestration happening up there, and what really ensures it is oil that's $80 or $100 a barrel.
Sure.
As long as oil prices are high, it's economic to burn the really dirty stuff.
Well, as long as there's no price on carbon, it's right. Economic to burn the really, the minute that there's a serious price on carbon, no one's going to go near the tar sands because that's expensive stuff to get at.
But they'll make less doing it, sure. Yeah.
It's just a cost curve. I mean, you put a $50 a ton price on carbon, you've closed off Alberta to exploration, and you've closed off a lot of places. And that's what we need to do, because we need to start forcing ourselves off this stuff.
Coming up next, George H.W. Bush, President of the United States, announces the commencement of the bombing of Iraq in the Gulf War in 1990. Approximately 20 to 35,000 military people were killed. Over 1,000 Kuwaiti civilians died, and approximately 3,664 Iraqi civilians died.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd, when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor. Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined. This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait. Now, the 28 countries with forces in the Gulf area have exhausted all reasonable efforts to reach a peaceful resolution, have no choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail. As I report to you, air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential. We will also destroy his chemical weapons facilities. Much of Saddam's artillery and tanks will be destroyed. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal. Initial reports from General Schwarzkopf are that our operations are proceeding according to plan. Our objectives are clear. Saddam Hussein's forces will leave Kuwait. The legitimate government of Kuwait will be restored to its rightful place. And Kuwait will once again be free. Iraq will eventually comply with all relevant United Nations resolutions, and then, when peace is restored, it is our hope that Iraq will live as a peaceful and cooperative member of the family of nations, thus enhancing the security and stability of the Gulf. Some may ask, why act now? Why not wait? The answer is clear. The world could wait no longer. Sanctions, though having some effect, showed no signs of accomplishing their objective. Sanctions were tried for well over 5 months, and we and our allies concluded that sanctions alone would not force Saddam from Kuwait. While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation, no threat to his own. He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities, and among those maimed and murdered, innocent children. While the world waited, Saddam sought to add to the chemical weapons arsenal he now possesses an infinitely more dangerous weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon. And while the world waited, while the world talked peace and withdrawal, Saddam Hussein dug in and move massive forces into Kuwait. While the world waited, while Saddam stalled, more damage was being done to the fragile economies of the Third World, the emerging democracies of Eastern Europe, to the entire world, including to our own economy. The United States, together with the United Nations, exhausted every means at our disposal to bring this crisis to a peaceful end. However, Saddam clearly felt that by stalling and threatening and defying the United Nations, he could weaken the forces arrayed against him. While the world waited, Saddam Hussein met every overture of peace with open contempt. While the world prayed for peace, Saddam prepared for war. I had hoped that when the United States Congress, in historic debate, took its resolute action, Saddam would realize he could not prevail and would move out of Kuwait in accord with the United Nations resolutions. He did not do that. Instead, he remained intransigent, certain that time was on his side. Saddam was warned over and over again to comply with the will of the United Nations, leave Kuwait or be driven out. Saddam has arrogantly rejected all warnings. Instead, he tried to make this a dispute between Iraq and the United States of America. Well, he failed. Tonight, 28 nations, countries from five continents, Europe and Asia, Africa and the Arab League, have forces in the Gulf area standing shoulder to shoulder against Saddam Hussein. These countries had hoped the use of force could be avoided. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.